I'd like you to turn your Bibles to Proverbs chapter 5. Proverbs chapter 5. And we're going to read responsively this text. But before we do, I want to set a rather broader context. If you have the Pew Bible, it's page 667. Proverbs chapter 5. We're looking at Solomon's attempt to help his children, his sons in particular, understand what marriage is about. I want to set a rather larger context for this. First of all, culturally and politically in our own day and age, and then secondly, what I think Solomon's attempting to do, not only in this chapter, but in fact throughout the whole book of Proverbs. You will admit with me that our culture, our country, in the past year has been in turn riveted, repulsed, and virtually unresponsive to the issues of marriage, fidelity, lies, and power. In some respects, these issues are not new. They're not new to the affairs that are occurring in Washington or other parts of the world. They are true in the human condition. What's fascinating to me has been to read the newspaper in the morning and then read Proverbs a little bit later. I encourage you sometime to do that. In particular, what Solomon does in this chapter stands in stark contrast to where our country is at the latter part of 1998. And so it's with that context I want to understand with you what this chapter is all about. I'm not to suggest that Solomon is writing to the young men of his court. He's not particularly writing to women because those women, those girls at that point didn't have access to the same form of education. I think we can take it and very easily make it applicable to both men and women today. In fact, as I do that, meeting with some of the high school students on Wednesday nights, I've basically taken some of Solomon's words and applied them to high school life because they are pertinent to that. Now, what is Solomon about as we read this text? I want to suggest two things. In your outline, I give them just in brief form. First of all, he's undertaking an effort to expose the country to a public policy in the form of personal narrative. What seems to be initially a series of dialogues from a father to a son are basically spoken within the context of the whole court. And they're meant to be disseminated, to be given throughout the whole country. Therefore, this individual, it seems like very intimate conversation that a father is having with his son is in the realm really public policy for all of Israel in the 10th century BC. I find that fascinating, frankly, that what Solomon doesn't do is give a list of principles, but rather engages in a dialogue, an intimate dialogue with his son. We still do it that way. Within the legal system, within law schools itself, many law schools still use a case study approach to the pursuit of law. I find that we learn a great deal more about human history reading biography than sometimes we do great movements. But that's what Solomon's about. The best policy continues as personal narrative. And therefore, the way to help people understand why a country should be led is to engage sons and parents, daughters and mothers, fathers and sons together. That means that the old adage is true. He who or she who rocks the cradle rocks the world. Do you understand what's happening personally? Personal narrative has implications at large. It may not be seen immediately, but it is true eventually. The second thing that Solomon will deal with, and we'll look at this at the end of the chapter, is that personal behavior, individual behavior, has cosmic significance. This is the flip side of the coin. Not only is the personal of significance to the common weal, the common good, but individual actions are seen by God and affect eternity. That means that what we do in our personal and intimate relationships is something that God inspects. Therefore, no one is a small person in the economy of God. Let me try and put it another way around. Even private actions have cosmic significance. Solomon's going to move to that point at the end of chapter 5. He's going to suggest that. Now, we have just heard a song that Heather sang that indicates that very thing. You understand that it's the faithful obedience of a man and a woman, Mary and Joseph, even against cultural tradition, Their obedience to the will of God results in a home for the Savior of the world. And God often delights in taking the very small and private obediences of you and I and magnifying them to have universal significance. That's what Solomon is attempting to do in chapter 5. Encourage his sons to see that what they do personally matters publicly. What they do privately is something God sees and therefore has importance for eternity. Now, with that backdrop, note that what Solomon does in chapter 5 is give us three things that we ought to do regarding intimate and personal relationships. We're to avoid those who would detract from marriage. Two, we're supposed to appreciate the joys that God gives in marriage. And three, we're supposed to acknowledge God because he's the one that sees and overlooks all of marriage. I want you to read along with me in chapter 5. I'll read the odd number verses. You join in and read the even-numbered verses, and we'll understand how Solomon portrays wisdom's view of marriage in this text. Let me begin. You come along on verse 2. My son, pay attention to my wisdom. Listen well to my words of insight, that you may maintain discretion and your lips may preserve knowledge. For the lips of an adulteress drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil. But in the end, she is as bitter as gall, sharp as a double-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lead straight to the grave. She gives no thought to the way of life. Her paths are crooked, but she knows it not. Now then, my sons, listen to me. Do not turn aside from what I say. Keep a path far from her. Do not go near the door of her house, lest you give your best strength to others and your years to one who is cruel, lest strangers feast on your wealth and your toil enrich another man's house. At the end of your life, you will groan. When your flesh and body are spent, you will say, "How I hated discipline. How my heart spurned correction. I would not obey my teachers or listen to my instructors. I have come to the brink of utter ruin in the midst of the whole assembly. Drink water from your own cistern, running water from your own well. Should your springs overflow in the streets, your streams of water in the public squares, let them be yours alone, never to be shared with strangers. May your fountain be blessed. May you rejoice in the wife of your youth. A loving doe, a graceful deer, may her breast satisfy you always. May you ever be captivated by her love. Why be captivated, my son, by an adulteress? Why embrace the bosom of another man's wife? For a man's ways are in full view of the Lord, and he examines all his paths. The evil deeds of a wicked man ensnare him. The cords of his sin hold him fast. He will die for lack of discipline, led astray by his own great folly." It's like reading headlines, don't you think? Solomon presents wisdom's view of marriage as having three essential ingredients. Three primary activities, and they are found very much easily within the dividing of the chapter. Verses 3 through 14, he talks about avoiding the detractors of marriage, those who would tend to pull down that most intimate of relationships. Verses 15 to 20, he talks about appreciating the joys of marriage. We'll have something to say about that because I think the voice of that has been lost from the Christian public to the larger secular public of our world. And finally, in the last three verses, he says that we should acknowledge that the Lord of marriage sees into the heart and mind, into the pathway and steps of a man. Now, understand that this is the second of five sections or warnings about adultery and marriage that are found in the first nine chapters of the book of Proverbs. We already looked at the first one in chapter 2, verses 16 to 19. In that particular segment, what Solomon does is he unites both the private and public realms of marriage.
He's making a case that marriage is both a private act and a public act. In the ancient world, there was no such thing as coming to church to enact the wedding, but what happened was the father would take his bride, his daughter, and bring her to the house of the intended. And the ceremony would take place outside the house of this man, and the whole village would gather round. And by the cementing, the giving and receiving of son and daughter, the marriage would be enacted. And then the son, the husband at that point, would take the bride into his house, and they would consummate their union. It was something that was both private and public. It had implications not only for them personally, but it had to do everything with the maintaining of the covenantal relationship that God had with his people. And the village, because the village was small, had a vested interest in making sure that that marriage survived. Because if it didn't, there were implications for both the families and the extended folk who were there. That's what Solomon talks about in chapter 2. In chapter 5, he will address the short and long-term consequences of both marriage and immorality. We'll look at them in a little bit. Chapter 6, he's going to look in further detail of the economics of immorality. Fascinating. We'll look at that in a little bit further time. Chapter 7, Solomon is going to look at the tactics of immorality, how an adulteress will seduce and try to bring a man down from the vows that he has made. And in chapter 9, Solomon is going to make a direct contrast to that passage we already looked at in chapter 8 by comparing the folly, the woman folly, with the woman wisdom. Now understand in this text that while Solomon uses the adulteress in feminine form, he's not saying that all women are evil. He's basically using something that would apply to the sons to whom he's speaking. If it was a mixed group, I'm sure he would use indiscriminately both men and women. So he's not making the point that all women are bad and sons watch out for them. In fact, he will commend to their attention the lady wisdom who is to be embraced, to be enjoyed. And in this particular text, he starts to teach his son and his court the joys of marriage itself. Before getting there, let's look at what and how Solomon talks about avoiding the detractors of marriage, in particular the adulteress. Solomon gives us four reasons why we should avoid it. We should avoid this woman or these detractors because of their speech, verses 3 and 4. This woman is a smooth and sweet talker, but her words are ultimately sharp and sword-like. It's a series of contrasts. Initially, her words seem to be full of life, but the result, the longer-term implication, is the words are cutting. The words are like taking something that's like gall-like bitterness into one's body. Don't you find that true? That sometimes evil people are the best talkers. I find it particularly true when I get up before you. The words that I find that I really want to say, in the attempt to speak truth, sometimes my words get twisted. Sometimes you've had that attempt to try and tell people about Jesus, and it seems like the word just don't get out. On the contrary, when I want to tell a lie sometimes, and I've told one in my life, maybe two, sometimes the words just flow. They flow. Beware of words, friends. Beware of words. Measure the words against the long-term impact. We live in an age of the soundbite. We don't hold people's words over the long haul. So if we only have 15 minutes of fame, as Andy Warhol said, the question becomes, do a person's words mean anything? Secondly, Solomon says you should avoid her because of her steps. The steps lead to death. They lead to Sheol. Her feet, the feet of folly, lead her associates to the death of Hades. Her steps are not firmly fixed. There's the contrast between the allurement of the short term and the long-term effect of where a person's life leads. One of the most devastating things I've had the horror to do is to talk to people who at the end of life realize they made a mess of their early life and they live with regret. what seems to be full of life in the short term, ultimately end of life, is filled with death and decay. Watch not only the speech, but the steps, verse 5. And then in verse 6, and I find this rather instructive, he tells his sons to avoid her because of her skepticism. She is superficial and unstable. And what's fascinating, if you read the commentaries of this particular verse, the Hebrew text is uncertain. Some of you that have other translations will note great variance in this particular verse. The best literal translation goes something like this. Her ways, that is the ways of the adulteress, are unstable in order that she may not prepare the paths of life. It doesn't seem to make quite sense. So the best understanding of the text, as far as I can see, it goes this way. She is so evil that she knows not that her ways are unstable. She wanders without knowing that she in fact is lost. You know, there's a quality to living the lie where pretty soon you don't even realize that you're not living truthfully. And so what Solomon warns his sons against are those people who live a life of skepticism and instability. My two older children are living within the secular college campus world, where the goddess and the god of skepticism reigns supreme. Many of the faculty members there, all they want to do is to cast doubt. Now, they do it supposedly with the intention to encourage you to examine your beliefs. But oftentimes, if you ask them what they believe, they will not give you that, because then it opens them to criticism as well. Oftentimes, skepticism against any belief becomes a belief itself. Solomon warns his sons against the person who is unstable and doesn't even know it. So beware, first of all, the speech that's smooth and yet sharp. Beware the steps that lead straight to death. Beware the skepticism that says, you know, you can't really know anything for sure. Just live for the moment. Enjoy pleasure now. Forget about the long term. And finally, Solomon will say in verses 7 to 14, avoid this woman. Avoid those who detract from marriage because of the suffering they will bring. And he outlines what that will be in verses 9, 10, and then 11 to 14. That at the end of life, if you don't avoid her, you will be spending your own strength, you will squander your own wealth, you will spurn one's teachers, and you will live with regret. Detractors don't save, they spend. Now the portrait here raises four incredibly personal and public questions that I think is important whether you're married or not. And I think we need to take these, if Solomon's writing public policy, to ask these questions of ourselves. I've started to do it myself. First of all, what's the quality of my speech? Is my speech something that builds up or something that tears down? Secondly, what's the direction of my steps? We're coming to the end of year 1998. As you look at the last year, what has been the general direction of your steps? Is your life moving in a wholesome direction toward God, or is it moving away from it? Thirdly, what's the nature of my beliefs? Do I engage in skepticism that keeps me from full-hearted and wholehearted obedience to the Lord? Or do I like to raise doubt at every turn? You know, but those Christians, you never can trust them. I don't want to commit too hard, wholeheartedly to anybody because they always kill you at the end. If so, you're like the adulteress here. And finally, what are the consequences of my life on others? Do they grow strong or do they shrivel? What's fascinating to me is to read these words in light of our own country, because we're coming, of course, to the end of the 20th century. One survey I read said that the most influential woman in the 1900s, 1900 to 1999, has been predicted to be Marilyn Monroe. Isn't that fascinating? Now, if you apply her life to the things that Solomon mentions here, it should give us pause. That's the negative view. Let's look at a rather more positive view in verses 15 to 20. Solomon says, not only avoid the detractors, but appreciate the joys of a wise marriage. In direct contrast to this portrait of the adulteress, Solomon launches into a description of marriage that parallels only the Song of Solomon. You gotta read the Song of Solomon, friends. Last Wednesday, a couple Wednesdays ago, we had a couple teen leaders read the first two chapters out loud to each other. Imagine what that does to some of the teens. They first go like this. I'm on a little crusade here, friends. I really am. I'm departing from my outline, but I'm on a crusade here because I believe that we're caught in a dilemma. I will not, and I cannot. It's not important for, not appropriate for me to talk about the details of my sexual relationship with my wife. But it is vitally important that young people know that I love my wife. It's important that they know you do too. So one of the things, if you're married, I'd like you to do is go out of here holding hands with your spouse. And of course, all the kids will come up from the teen department. What did they do here? But the problem is that all that they see in the world is sexual relationships between people who are not married. And that's the predominant arena within which the appreciation of what God has created is seen in our culture. So no wonder high school students grow up and they figure that the only thing that makes fun is when that's done outside of marriage. Solomon says, no, appreciate the joys of marriage. Note how he says it here. He says, first of all, appreciate the wife of your youth. And it's frankly a sensual thing. He says, among other things, that she is a loving doe, a graceful deer. May her breast satisfy you always. If you read the Song of Solomon, it gets even more explicit than that. It's wonderful stuff. And in reaction to the horrific way in which sex is treated in our culture, oftentimes Christians come across as being virtually neutered. You can have my passions here, because Solomon says it. The sense here is of the contrast. Don't be satisfied with someone who tears down marriage, but be satisfied with the wife of your youth. Here, the sense is that God has created it in a wonderful way. And I think, frankly, fathers need to tell sons that they love their mother. And mothers need to tell their daughters that they love their father. There's got to be an exchange within the Christian community. Sometimes our kids kill us no end because we hug in the kitchen. Oh, they're up to it again. You know how that works. But we need to do it. When I do premarriage counseling, we give an extended questionnaire. And one of the questions that I ask is, what would you like about your marriage to be different than that of your parents' marriage? And dimes to dozen, what comes across more often than not is that young people would like their marriage to be more frankly expressive than their of their parents. I understand there's some cultural shifts here, but I'm saying that our community desperately needs to show both the young people who are downstairs and out in the gym that being a Christian man and wife is a wonderful thing. That's the first sense in the word appreciate. Enjoy it. Cultivate it. Nurture it. Go off on weekends together and leave the kids at home. Well, you mean you're leaving us? Yeah, we kind of like each other a little bit more than we like you. And it's not a bad thing to say. I'm getting in over my head here, friends. But you catch my drift, I think. But there's a second aspect of the word appreciate that I think Solomon is mentioning here. It's an economic sense. The idea here is built into the marriage relationship something that its value increases. Make it appreciate. Do you understand the way I'm using the term here? I want it sort of like your house. I want you to do upkeep to it so that it's more valuable now than it was when you first got it. Hear what Solomon says is, note, there's a contrast between his maintenance of the cistern and his maintenance of his marriage. In the ancient world and in Palestine, it was a semi-arid environment. The maintaining of one's private water supply was a matter of life and death. So within each house, there was a cistern, a large cavity within which pure drinking water was maintained. The contrast is that the wastewater treatment plant took place that after the water had been used, it was thrown out on the streets and there was washed down. And Solomon says, you don't take your drinking water from the street. but you maintain and you increase value to that that's within your own domicile, your own cistern. So note the comparison. The idea is that the marriage relationship is to be nurtured, maintained, made safe, not only for yourself, but for those in your home. You don't drink water that gushes down the gutter, but you drink the water that's from your own cistern. Hence, this sense of appreciation is a wonderful thing. In fact, Solomon's going to talk about it in the next chapter. But the sense is, guard your marriage, add to it in such a way that it becomes more valuable in the passage of time. The rhetorical question that Solomon mentions in verse 20, why be captivated, has the answer, you would be dumb to do it. It would be akin to, among other things, taking your drinking water from the waste management system of the town. The appeal is to economic and common sense. Historians have said that one of the keys to the vitality of the Israelite community in the 6th, 4th, 5th, 6th centuries before Jesus came was the fact that the warrior was told to stay home and comfort his wife in the first year of marriage. There was a priority given to the establishment and the nurturing of marriage. We may need to grab hold of that again. Now, there's a pendulum here, friends. Sometimes you can make a religion and a god of marriage. Marriages exist for other purposes than our mutual pleasure. But at least this text seems to suggest, appreciate it. Not only enjoy, but make it richer. Make it something that holds within it the waters that give life to those around. Finally, Solomon concludes with these great verses, verses 21 to 23. Look at them again with me. Acknowledge the Lord's view of marriage. These verses begin with the word for, chapter 5, verse 21. For this reason. In other words, everything that's gone before, what Solomon has talked about in terms of avoiding and appreciating, is done for a reason. What's the reason? Because a man's ways are in full view of the Lord. He examines all his paths. Private actions are private for the world around, but God sees. Therefore, how I conduct myself in the most intimate of relationships is something that the Lord sees. God sees a man's ways, and in the long term, the evil that a person does ensnares a wicked man. We don't have time to go into the poetry of this. I hope in the coming year to be able to help you see how Solomon packs in, even in poetic format, these proverbs. We understand they're connected. They're not connected right away. We'll talk about that in a bit. But what Solomon is concerned is that you understand that God sees into a person's life. Nothing is hidden from him. So the question remains, what if I'm not married? What if I've been divorced? What if I've made errors of judgment or my behavior? The tenth of the chapter is this, that if our primary relationships are to be nurtured and cultivated, then that's the way in which I can live anticipating marriage or recovering from the mistakes of my past. God's view of marriage should be a model for all our dealings, both with the same sex and the opposite sex. When I talk to the high school students, I say, you know, there was no such thing as dating in the ancient world. All the marriages were arranged. Some of them go, oh, gross. Can you imagine who my parents would pick for me? I've thought about that. As a form of punishment, no less. No. But, you know, I'm concerned not so much by what they think, but who they associate with. As a parent, one of your fundamental concerns is the peer group that your kids hang out with. It's important. So I say to the high school students, I say to you, if this is the goal of marriage, is where relationships are heading, not that everyone could marry, but if primary or intimate relationships are supposed to look like this, they're supposed to be enhanced, nurtured, made more valuable. Whether or not we're married or not, you look around the people in this room, we're supposed to treat each other kindly because we're part of the bride of Christ. We're supposed to nurture one another because somehow or other God's concerned to present his own son with a bride that looks good. then therefore, if that's the goal, then all of relationships take their cue from it. And the way you treat one another now is sets in motion a pattern for how you will treat your spouse in the event you should get married, and if you are not to be married, how you will treat other intimate relationships in your life. Therefore, within the body of Christ, within the Christian community, let's avoid those who would detract from it. Let's appreciate those relationships that God brings into our sphere of reference. And let's acknowledge that it's God who sees our motives. He sees our path. We can fake out some of the people, some of the time, all the people, and you know the rest of the rhyme. But you can't fake out God. I don't see them in the audience today. Maybe they're here. Yes, they are here. Don and Madeline Fales, will you stand up, please? It's your 55th wedding anniversary today. Sorry to embarrass you like that, but I have an inside source, you see. I think he still likes her, you know. Occasionally I see them holding hands together. I think I'd like to do that when I'm, you know, married that long. You go up and ask how it happens if you've been on the way a little bit longer. Brothers and sisters, let's avoid the things that detract from the quality of relationship that Proverbs 5 talks about. Brothers and sisters, let's appreciate one another. If this text is not just for the personal relationships that Solomon's sons would have with other women, but becomes a public policy, can you understand the implications about how people should have treated one another in Palestine in the 10th century BC? Let's be careful about our speech, our steps, the tendency to doubt God's goodness and love and be skeptical. Let's be people who build into each other things that are warm and enduring. And finally, let's acknowledge that God sees everything. And because he sees everything, he wants what's best in our life, doesn't he? He's not ogre-like, looking over the balconies of heaven and saying, cut it out! But he's saying he's looking over with interest. Enjoy what I've given you. That's the context here. Sometimes I wonder how they did it. By they, I mean Mary and Joseph. Can you imagine growing up, having a son grow up in your house that was virtually perfect? Now, I have a couple who grow up and they think they're perfect. But here's Mary and Joseph, and their husband and wife, and Jesus is living in their home. I want to suggest, friends, that it's a model because, in fact, Jesus is growing and living in your home. And if you're not married, he's part of your apartment, part of your household, part of your condo. Because the text says that God sees a man's path. Doesn't that fill you with hope? It fills you with hope that God's intention and design is for our good, for our pleasure, for our instruction, and for our nurture.